This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to The Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight we have with us Dr. Henry Stapp. How are you, Henry?
Just fine.
Thanks for coming on the show. I've been looking forward to this show for 6 months now, ever since we scheduled it months ago. Why don't you tell my listeners just a little bit about you before we get started so they know who you are, what you're doing, and where you're at, and your new book.
Well, I'm a physicist at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, University of California, and in principle, I'm an elementary particle physicist, theoretical physicist, and recently my interests have been on the problem of the interaction between the mind, namely our conscious thoughts, our subjective experiences, and our brains, the relationship between mind and brain. And essentially my thesis is that quantum theory has a great deal to do with this, that you cannot really understand this connection within classical physics, where the brain is regarded as just a bunch of particles, basically, moving around, and there's no way that of understanding how consciousness can come out of bouncing billiard balls, so to speak. On the other hand, quantum theory is designed to be a theory of relationships between our experiences, and it's closely tied into mathematical descriptions of a physical nature that are designed to connect and form relationships between experiences. So quantum theory provides an appropriate and beautiful way of understanding the connection between mind and brain. You mentioned my book. I have a new book that's just being typeset now. Springer Verlag. It's entitled The Mindful Universe, Quantum Mechanics, and the Participating Observer. I expect it'll be out in within a month, I think.
I want to, tonight, I think I told you, what I'm trying to do is let everybody understand that what you're saying and what it means. So I want to start off clarifying a few things. First of all, when you talk about consciousness, what is your definition of consciousness?
Well, you can define things in various ways, and one way of defining things is to point out examples. You point out examples of automobiles and things like this, and I think most people know what their flow of conscious experiences are. You experience pains, joys, happiness, sorrow, all sorts of feelings. And in psychology, these are sometimes called your stream of conscious thoughts, or thoughts, ideas, and feelings. And so that's what people in this field refer to as mind, stream of conscious thoughts. And brain, on the other hand, is something that's made up of neurons and other physically described substances and located in your head and within your skull. So there are two things that are described in quite different languages. Neurons are described in a physical language and also in the mathematical language of physics, and conscious experiences are described in terms of psychological concepts and ideas, pains, feelings, thoughts, ideas, and feelings in general.
So just to add one more leg to that, you're not saying that consciousness is simply the opposite of being asleep? Because some people think that.
Well,
And I guess that's a good definition just for that limited.
Yes, when you go to sleep in a sound sleep, dreamless sleep, you are not having conscious experiences almost. I mean, that's, and many people characterize consciousness as the, in a sense, the difference between being awake and alert and having conscious experiences and being asleep where you have no conscious experiences. So I don't think there's any conflict between those two ways of characterizing.
We're just talking about much more than that. Would you agree? Now, what is your definition of mind? Because we're also going to be talking about that tonight.
Well, I think I've just, in effect, given it. Mind is essentially flow of conscious experiences. And so consciousness and mind are, the way I use the term, are essentially the same, just two ways of referring to the same thing, namely your streams of conscious experiences. And mind is just one word that identifies those things.
Okay. Would you agree with me that we have three levels of awareness, sensate, cognitive, and self?
Yes, I think there are three things that can be present in your stream of consciousness, at least three things, and certainly those are three of them.
Are there some more that you know of that I didn't mention?
Well, I'm not sure how a feeling of anguish fits into your category. Maybe it does. Any sort of experience that you have, love, joy, hate, in addition to visual experiences and things that come immediately through your senses, you have also things that are perhaps more subtle. In any case, we certainly want to include anything that you're subjectively conscious of, anything that's in your flow of consciousness.
Okay, what do you believe to be the source of intention?
Well, I think that intention is an aspect of certain of your experiences. Certain of your experiences have intentionality in the sense that you're intending to do something. You're meaning, you have a goal of doing something. And certainly it comes in part probably from the brain. Certainly what your brain is doing has an effect or an influence on all of your thinking. And the question is, can it be completely characterized and described and understood just in terms of what your brain is doing? Or is there some origin or part of the origin also in things that are not completely described in terms of brain activity? In other words, our reasons, are these things that we call experiences completely described in terms of brain activity, or do we have something more general that has two aspects, two ways of describing different aspects of the reality, one being a psychological description, one being a physical description? And if you have these two aspects of the underlying reality, then your intentions, like your other thoughts, could very well have origins, partial origins, in both of these aspects.
Okay. Do you think it's a process? And if so, what do you believe to be its active agent? Is it just awareness, sensate, or cognitive?
Well, as we experience our life, as I say, we understand what we mean by our flow of conscious experiences, and the elements of this flow stream of consciousness are our conscious thoughts, and so they are in part of the reality, and they certainly have origins in things that have come before in the in the creation of the factual universe, the past, and presumably, if nature really has aspects that can be described in terms of psychological ideas, in terms of experiences, and also aspects that can be described in terms of physical description, mathematical description, in terms of physical ideas, the origin of your present conscious experiences, your flow of consciousness at the moment, presumably has origins in, or could very well have origins coming partly from the psychological and partly from the physical aspects of what has come before.
Do you think that there are gradients of consciousness?
And what do you mean by that?
Is it hierarchical?
Well, I mean, I think, in several senses. Certainly, your intentions, if you have an intention to do something, like lifting a heavy stone, you can feel a difference in the intensity there. There can be a more intense effort. You try to lift the stone, and the effort you're applying is not great enough, and so there's a quantitative aspect here, which you might call a gradient, more and less, and you can apply more effort, and perhaps you can lift the heavy stone. So in that sense, there is a quantitative aspect that you feel, more effort or less effort.
All right, let me ask you this. Conventional science is not listening to us right now about the intention and the holographic environment. Do you think, you know, different people have different levels of awareness, of understanding, and trying to talk to some of them about this is like talking to a telephone pole sometimes. We were talking about gradients of conscious awareness. You know, there are different people in the world who perceive, understand, and accept things differently. Even if it's been presented as fact, they deny it even when it's right in front of their face. You know, people don't understand mystical experiences until they have one, and then it changes someone. How would quantum theory explain that, or would it support that? Or do you know?
Well, I think the fact that different people understand things differently doesn't need any particular
it's not just
difficult explanation. I mean, we all have different, we grow up, we learn things differently, we have different experiences, life experiences, and this is a complex subject, you know, extending back 2,000 years, and these things have been discussed. So there's a tremendous amount of material that's out there in the literature that people can read, and many different points of view. Most of the philosophers of the past have addressed these questions, and we're now faced with, or have the advantage of having a lot of technical data from neuroscience, and on the other hand, the brain is a very complicated system, so you know, it's not to be expected, I think, that everybody's going to immediately have the same.
Are you familiar with David Hawkins' work in Power versus Force, his research that he's done on conscious awareness?
I guess not.
Okay. How do you think that intention is carried out? What makes it come to be?
Well, I think it's intentionality, or the intentional aspect of your experiences, like if I intend to raise my arm or if I intend to steer my car in a certain direction or whatever, according to William James any intention like this, who is, I guess, your listeners will be familiar with William James, probably the most famous American psychologist and philosopher, perhaps. Your intentions arise, he says, from your brains. Your brains throw out a due to the situation in which you find yourself, the brain puts up a certain causes, in some sense, a certain idea of what you ought to do in this situation, and so the initial thought, the initial feeling of intention, according to William James, arises actually from brain activity, and the contribution to that from something that's beyond brain activity, in other words, consciousness, seems to be an effect that holds in place this idea. So there's a kind of a two-fold causal situation here. First, the brain throws up a certain idea that you should, under the present circumstances, act in a certain way. And according to William James, and also quantum theory, the consciousness aspect is then able to keep this idea in place for longer than would be the case without the intervention of the conscious thoughts. And quantum theory explains in a very neat way how this really could come about, and in a way that fits a lot of data. So it's a twofold causal. There's a twofold causation involved here, with your intentions and with the holding in place of your intentions, so that they actually result in actions.
Do you think that, I want to get clear on this, does the brain think, or does it just process? Does it actually create? Does it have creativity, or does it process?
Well, you have to understand what the brain is or is supposed to be according to physics. Now, according to classical physics, all it is kind of some particles, which are just tiny bits of matter, hard bits of matter moving around, and some forces that are causing these tiny particles to move around. That's the old classical picture of what the brain is. But quantum theory has a completely different picture of what both the brain and the physical world in general is made up of. And according to quantum mechanics, quantum physics, the actual structure of nature is made up of psychophysical events, namely events that have both a psychological aspect and a physical aspect, the physical aspect being in some sense a reflection in the physical world of the experiential or psychological aspect. So from this point of view, the brain is, according to quantum ideas, really a sequence of events that has within it both psychological and physical aspects. And so every actual part of the brain has a psychological aspect, so it doesn't really have to throw it up. What is happening is that there is a sequence of these events, each of which has a psychological aspect. And so it's part of the brain's natural function to have, in principle, psychological aspects. Now, some of these aspects which are probably best understood as feelings of one sort or another. Some of them are rise to the level of consciousness, and some are, even though perhaps best understood as feelings, are still at below the level of conscious awareness. And so the upshot of all this is that your brain naturally generates things that are best described as feelings, and some of these are powerful enough to, and are well organized and complex enough, and have the necessary structure to be conscious feelings. So the brain automatically is producing these things, and as a consequence of the situation in which you, the person with that brain, find yourself. You find yourself in some situation, and the brain goes to work to create an appropriate response to your situation. And this response will often have conscious consist or contain conscious experiences.
Where does the brain get its information? I mean, is the information contained within the physical body, within the brain, or is it contained within a field or a wave or a frequency or something?
Well, given that the brain is what I just described it to be, namely, it's a sequence of events, of psychophysical events that have occurred in the past, and there are causal laws that that transfer the basically the intentions and the information from the past to the present. So the causal chain here involves the transmission of both the psychological and the physical aspects of the earlier events forward in time, and your later experiences are a consequence of the way your brain integrates the earlier information in order to produce new psychophysical events.
Okay, let me ask you this then. A lot of us that are mystics, everybody gets them, but mystics in particular pay attention. When we get information, when you get an idea, it all drops in one big lump. You know, it's not something you think, oh, I need to think about this and figure it out. It just comes all at one time. Where does that come from?
Well, that's part of what I've just talked about. These events are whole events. Already, William James back at 100 years ago, and before that, psychologists had what is called a threshold effect, namely that all of your experiences, all of your perceptions, come, as he says, totally or not at all. So the whole unified thought appears as a unified thought. That's the way all thought comes to us. And
where does it come from, though?
Well, when you try to ask these questions, you know, you can answer this from two points of view. One is, what does contemporary science say about it? And when you ask these why questions, contemporary science probably does not give an adequate or a full answer, but there's an elaboration of what scientists have found, which was created by Alfred North Whitehead, and he actually describes what he believes to be the structure by which these events form themselves out of the facts coming from the past and the experiences from the past.
I have a question here. When you say from the past, do you mean from the individual's past?
No, what I mean...
the past and all there is.
I mean a past in the global sense.
Mm-hmm.
According to... this picture, there is the reality is created by a sequence of events that are occurring, and each one fixes certain facts to be this, not that, and in association with a psychological element. And so you can think of the evolving structure of the universe is being created, and once these events have occurred, then they are in the past, and you have fixed past facts that constitute the history of the world, and you then have the process that's now happening, which is based upon what has happened in the past and the laws that relate what has happened in the past to potentialities for what is going to be happening now. So when I say the past, I mean things have already been fixed by this process of that creates the factual universe.
Do you think that we live in a holographic environment, that that's the way physical reality is experienced?
Well, certainly your experiences come from combining various elements from the past that come often from different locations. So in that sense, spatially separated facts in the past get combined to form a new factual element in the present. And so if that's what you mean by holographic, namely that that a distribution in the past is contributing to the formation of the present, then that's pretty understandable. I mean, we all understand, even in ordinary experience, how different influences from different places in the past can converge and cause the present reaction, whatever it might be, mm-hmm. to those. So, in that sense, even non-mystically, or in any kind of ordinary thought, would say that yes, in that sense, we have a holographic universe. If you want to talk about holography as a technical thing having to do with certain laws of optics, and then that's a much more subtle thing, and the extent to which that holds is probably the way you'd like to pose it is, well, one way to pose it is, to what extent is, for example, memory in the brain? For example, Carl Prebrum, when he talks about holographic brain, does talk about a certain distributed aspect of memory throughout the brain, so that it's... And he would like to believe that a sort of a quantum mechanical superposition of these things is important in the formation of your new thoughts. Now, I think it's probably undoubtedly true that memory is in some sense distributed over large parts of the brain. Whether you need some... quantum interference effects to bring these things together, as is done in holography, I would be rather doubtful about, but perhaps it, you know, I don't think that the brain is able to maintain these quantum superposition effects over large distances that would be required for the usual ideas of holography to apply. On the other hand, it certainly is probably undoubtedly true that memory is distributed through the brain, so you could, depending, therefore, on what you want to call holographic, if you're talking about holography in the sense of a classically understandable combination of things from various regions, then I would say yes, memory is undoubtedly holographic or very likely holographic, whereas if you're talking about something requiring a sophisticated quantum superposition, as happens in optics, then my inclination would be to say, no, that probably can't happen in the brain.
Do you think that we create our reality as we go?
Certainly to a large extent, I think we do. What you expect to see and what certainly your attitudes, I think everybody would agree without being in any way mystical about it, that your intentions, your attitudes, your beliefs about what's going to happen and your intentions are all influencing what is going to happen in a very non-mystical way. And whether there is a deeper, hidden something going on, I'm not sure about. I know people who do believe that, and in my own life, it has never been, I've never had any thing that I would want to describe as coming from some source like this. And so I will maintain an open mind. Perhaps my own experience would incline me to skepticism, but certainly a lot of other people have a different belief about that.
You know, are you familiar with the movies that's been out, What the Bleep and The Secret?
I've seen What the Bleep, yes, I saw that movie.
Well, there's a new one out called The Secret, and it tells people that they create whatever they think. So if they think a positive thing, that that thing's going to, say if they think that they want a new car,
mm-hmm.
they can think about that new car long enough and eventually it appears.
Mm-hmm.
My personal opinion is that there is some truth to that and that things can manifest somehow through thought. But I don't think that we have complete free will to do that, because if we had complete free will, you know, you could say, Eva, I'm going to meet you at Starbucks at 3 o'clock, and you know, you may not get there at 3 o'clock because you don't have complete free will. Something else is driving the car. So what do you think about the power of thought and the creation of mass and physical reality?
Well, I suspect that insofar as you try to do controlled experiments to demonstrate this, you're probably going to not be able to achieve it. And if it does exist, it seems to be of a subtle sort of a thing that doesn't want to function when you put it to a scientific test. And I certainly know people who tell me from their own experience that this works very well for them, and whether the reason that it works is their own attitudinal change or something actually in the physical world is, as I say, it's something that certainly is difficult, if not impossible, to validate by scientific experiments. If it works for people, then, you know, they should probably believe it, and it may work for them.
You know, Bill Pillar's done some work with some fruit fly larvae, where he actually shipped them to the other side of the country and placed intention through controlled circumstances that they accelerated their growth rate by 25%, and they did that with just thought. How would quantum mechanics account for that? He had two batches, and one this one accelerated by 25%, and the other one stayed exactly where it was with thought. And he did the same with pH. He increased the pH in this water by 1 point and decreased it by 1 point with only thought. So how would that happen in quantum mechanics?
Well, as I say, usually if one, you know, the experimental evidence in situations like this is in question or in doubt, and there seems to be in all sorts of experiments like this experimenter effect. And, you know, some experimenters seem to be able to get effects like this, and other experimenters don't. And, of course, there are a lot of skeptical scientists who are very disinclined to believe something that can only be achieved by experimenters who believe it and cannot be achieved by skeptics. And so the whole thing is, the first question is, you know, to what extent is this a real effect, and to what extent is it something else? And I'm not sure myself that it's a real effect, but given, if you want to suppose it is real, quantum mechanics has both a virtue and a defect, that it is not complete. It's not dynamically or causally complete in its present form. There are certain causal gaps associated with what's called process one, and which is described as free choice on the part of the experimenter by Niels Bohr, for example, and Heisenberg, and some of the founders of quantum theory. So there is there are some aspects of quantum theory that are currently not closed. And so once you have an opening like that, then, of course, if it turns out that some phenomena really does exist, there would be an opening in quantum theory to say, well, this thing that we don't yet understand can be understood. You know, then you can do some development of the theory and develop in such a way as to account for things like this.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that quantum theory is currently in an incomplete state does give it the capacity to perhaps explain things like this insofar as they really need to be explained.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with Robert John's work?
Yes, quite.
Do you have any opinion on that or any comment on that?
Well, as you know, probably know, the big experiment they tried to do, they've been going for 20 years or more, and they developed an understanding of what works and what doesn't work, and devised this huge experiment that they were doing in conjunction with two laboratories in Germany. So all three were doing exactly the same protocol, and with a massive database that would presumably really settle things if things went in accord with how things had been going at this Pear Institute up until then. Well, they did the experiment, and the results were null. No results in any of the three laboratories of this thing that was supposed to be a confirmation of 20 years of research at Pear. So you have a negative result like that, and
they did have results. I've talked to Brenda Dunn about this at length.
Well,
they did have results. I mean,
the reports that I hear is that the results were negative in terms of what they expected. You can't, in these experiments, go after the fact and see things that you say, oh, that wasn't in the original protocol, but now we see some strange things that we say is an effect. That doesn't count in science. In science, you've got to say beforehand what you're expecting to see and what you're going to count as a positive result. And I think on that criterion, their results were null.
Huh. We've talked so long about that, and basically what Brenda said was that They did 10,000 experiments where they placed intention that all the balls were to fall to the left, and that's exactly what happened. Every ball fell to the left.
Well, that's not the way I understand the data. And in particular, we're talking now about these experiments that they did in these three laboratories independently. And I think every report that I have heard is that, and I've talked to people like Dean Radin and others who looked at it, and in terms of the stated goals of the experiment, which is the scientifically proper thing to use, the results were essentially null.
Wow.
So that's a big negative impact upon these claims. I mean, that doesn't mean that something's not going on, but it's certainly a big negative.
I'm just kind of floored there. I don't know what to say. What are your views about the idea of non-locality and entanglement at the macro level?
Well, I certainly believe that there is non-locality in quantum in the world, and insofar as the world conforms to the rules of quantum mechanics, I do believe that you cannot explain the phenomena and explain the predictions of quantum theory if you disallow any sort of faster-than-light transmission of information. And now, this transmission of information is even though the experiments that we're talking about are macroscopic experiments, and all of the predictions and all of the phenomena we're talking about are macroscopic. I mean, you're setting up devices, and you're looking at macroscopic responses of your detecting devices. So everything is macroscopic in that sense, that the phenomena is totally macroscopic, and yet the explanation, the phenomena is macroscopic, and you can deduce just from the macroscopic phenomena the need for fast and light transmission of information. So it is true, of course, that there is a microscopic element, namely that the predictions were based on some a theory of involving photons, individual photons, but certainly the phenomena is macroscopic, and you don't have to say where the predictions came from. The predictions are predictions about macroscopic things, and just from those macroscopic the character of the macroscopic phenomena is enough to conclude that there is this non-local connectedness in the quantum universe that is completely not understandable in terms of classical ideas.
Are you familiar with the work of Fritz Popp?
Yes, I am.
What do you have to say about that? And about, I mean, it basically states that we're beings of light, and the more light emitted, the more consciously aware or evolved someone is.
Well, the work of Popp that I'm familiar with has to do with the effect on biological systems of radiation, and I think it's probably valid experiments, but I don't think it says that we are beams of light. It says that light has an important influence on biological systems, and to say that we are beams of light, I think, goes far beyond what he would claim to have established. I mean, in fact, I myself wrote a while ago, and quite a few years ago, in a book dedicated to David Bohm, an article entitled "Light as Foundation of Being," where in fact I was propounding something like this, but certainly not in connection with anything that Fritz Popp was doing. I'm sorry, what was your question? What was your further
question? Somewhere I read that he had taken a corn stalk.
Right. Corn is one of the things that he works with.
And that what he saw with that piece of equipment that he had was an entire stalk of corn, and that corn seedling literally grew into that stalk.
That what?
That the corn seedling grew into the stalk of light that was there. That's what I read.
Oh, perhaps that could be. that he somehow had a beam of light and coming in from some direction, and that the germination and the development of the corn was along the direction of the light.
Mm-hmm. So wouldn't
that wouldn't seem to be too unlikely. I mean, if it needs some sort of sustenance from the light beam, it's just like sunflowers turn to the light. I mean, there's you do expect, and seeds grow.
Mm-hmm. All right. What role, if any, do you see consciousness playing in non-locality and entanglement?
Well, the way that these non-locality experiments are explained in quantum mechanics, part of the proof, if you want to call it that, of non-locality has to do with you have to assume, is one of the premises, that the way the experiment is set up, you have two regions and you have an experimenter in each region who in principle performs one of two possible experiments. So you have altogether four possible combinations of experiments. You have to assume that the choice made in each of the two regions between two possible experiments is a free choice. In other words, somehow it could have gone either way, and you assume that it could go either way, and that no matter which way it goes, the predictions of quantum theory will hold. And so there is this question, well, free choice. I mean, really, of course, the experiment goes one way or the other. The experimenter does one thing or he does the other, or he sets up the situation so that one experiment is performed or another. And so there's really, in some ultimate sense, not a freedom there. So, in other words, nature apparently goes one way or the other, at least it appears to us to go one way or the other. And so you do need, in order to even talk about this non-locality effect, the idea that there's some element of freedom here, of free choice. And usually that is associated in orthodox quantum theory with the words that the experimenter can freely choose to do this or that. And so that is the usual connection. There is an element of freedom which is granted to the experimenter in order to even start talking about cause and effect. You see, you want to be able to talk about changing a cause in one place and seeing its effect in another.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to even start to talk about that way of understanding cause and effect, you have to assume that the cause can be this or that. In other words, you can have one or the other experiment performed. And, mm-hmm. There is a close connection between freedom in some sense and locality in the normal proofs of non-locality.
All right, we've got just a couple more minutes, so I'm going to ask the final hard questions.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you a couple of questions all in one. First of all, what do you think that this will mean for our understanding in 10 years from now? And number two, does this, and if it does, how does it support the existence of God?
So, first question is, how will all this affect your understanding 10 years from now mm-hmm. of something, of everything, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And what was the second question?
Does it support the existence of God?
Existence of God.
What does this mean for our lives?
Well, that's the third question, right?
Yeah. Kind of all put in together.
Well, I think that right now, I think we're probably in a transitional period in terms of scientific understanding. At the moment, the people who believe in a materialistic universe and who discount the importance of quantum theory and understanding the role of human beings in the universe, it's kind of strange, but many of the scientists, neuroscientists that are involved, are still thoroughly wed to the idea that it can all be explained within the framework of classical mechanics, even though they all admit, and all the philosophers involved also admit, you know, and they're all basically starting from classical concepts. There's just no way of understanding how consciousness comes out of this sort of understanding, how it comes out of brain activity, if you're going to understand brain activity and the brain in terms of classical ideas. It's just that classical ideas just do not support. There's no conceptual foundation in classical physics for the idea that something like thoughts should come out of brain activity, and they all admit that it's a huge mystery. So I think in 10 years, I do believe that the importance of passing over to a quantum mechanical conception of nature will have made great strides, and people will realize that quantum mechanics provides a wonderful way of understanding these problems in ways that explain in a very natural way a lot of data. And so that's my answer to the first question. I think the importance of quantum theory, and of course that ties into your third question, the meaning of it all, because Steve Weinberg wrote a book, and in which he says, you know, all this progress in science, and yet we find no meaning there, no meaning in the universe. Whereas once you go to really a thorough, a completely quantum mechanical understanding of the brain in particular, and the human person in particular, then you see reasons, these things that I was describing in terms of consciousness, in terms of streams of consciousness, involve in a very important way reasons and meaning. I mean, you make your choices on the basis of what it means for you, and you have reasons for doing what you do. And so instead of having this mechanical idea of human beings as the mechanical devices that are kind of like clocks that just tick along and do what they've been programmed to do, when that gets replaced by a vision of human beings, a quantum mechanical vision, where there is this element of freedom involved, and in which reasons and meaning can inject themselves into behavior of people and beings, I think it will be a huge difference, because the whole morality, whole moral theory, ethical theory, is almost impossible in a mechanical view of the universe. The idea of responsibility makes no sense if everything was determined at the birth of the universe, and this is just clock-like universe grinding its way according to a predestined end, just makes no sense, whereas quantum theory really changes greatly the conception of human beings and how they fit into the universe. And they're now able to fit in a way that's able to allow them to inject meaning and into the universe and in accordance with their own, with the values that they have created in themselves over the course of their lives. So that is what I see as the big important consequence of all this, that that our lives, the meaningfulness of human life is tremendously enhanced in such a way as to create a certain foundation for ethical behavior that is lacking in a mechanical universe. Now let's see, that second question, the existence of God. Well, I guess I don't have an answer to that question. It may be that it looks like the meaning that I was talking about just a moment ago is kind of meaning on a local scale. I mean, individual human beings can have meaning and inject values, local values that they have into the behavior of the universe, the behavior of their own bodies, first of all, and in the creation of societies built upon their values. That doesn't require somehow this godlike overlord that it can say that values are important and meaning is important, but they develop on a more local scale without an overall objective aim. And so at the moment, it seems to me that this more limited idea of human-based values and meaning, where we create in our own lives and our own thinking and thoughts meaning and values and try to implement them, is certainly going to be implied by a quantum mechanical view of man and the universe. But there, of course, is the greater question, well, why are the laws of nature so friendly to the development of biological systems? And there is this famous anthropic question of why that is true. There's lots of parameters in the universe, charges and gravitational constants and many other parameters that seem to be just finely tuned to permit life as we know it to evolve. And so is that an accident? And what sort of process caused those parameters to be what they are? And certainly a lot of scientists are debating this issue today. It's a quite hot issue. And so far, no answer. Scientists do not agree on exactly where, how we should understand.
Yeah, they have trouble with that, don't they?
Yes, of course. One one answer is that, according to some recent developments in string theory, there should be, if you can think of this, a number this big, 10^500. Different possible universes in string theory. Now, if there are that many different universes and somehow they all exist, then it becomes not perhaps so unlikely that one of them exists that is friendly to life, and we are, of course, in one that's friendly to life, and the rest of them are just may be there, but without life. So These questions, in any case, are being batted around by scientists at the moment, and some are very unwilling to believe that it's all just a matter of chance, our living in one chance universe. But in any case, these are certainly questions that scientists are asking, and there's not general agreement at the moment on how to answer it. But, and I'm not sure you need a God to kind of specify that the laws will be such that it would be somehow nicer, I guess, from many points of view, to say that the universe, however, was created in such a way as to allow the generation of, maybe even favor the generation of situations that could become more complex. I mean, that's kind of the way I like to see it at the moment, that there may be a principle of favoring complex, the evolution of complex systems, and such a universe that was at least designed in that way, favoring complexity, might account for the friendliness of the universe to life.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're about out of time. Well, we are out of time. We're past time. Look, I'm so grateful we came on the show. I'd like for you to come back sometime, and we have about 50 more questions we'd like to ask you.
Okay.
Anyway, I wish you much success on your new book, The Mindful Universe, and agape to you.
Okay.
Thanks for coming on. Good night.